Happy Valley, your first network program was in 1928. Had you ever appeared on radio before that time?
At the Savoy Hotel in London, where I played from September 1924 to June of 25, I was merely a saxophonist in an seven-piece band, I think it was. I was the only saxophonist in it. We broadcast over the BBC nightly from the Savoy Hotel at least three or four nights a week. I wasn't the leader. I didn't sing. I just played my little part on the saxophone. And I had never heard, prior to my going in the air in February or March of February, I think it was 1928, from the High Hole Club in New York City, I had never heard an American radio program. I did hear that George Olson and his band had an hour show for Gulf Oil, and they were paid $1,500, which to me, as a boy who would leave New Haven, as I did the first day at Yale at 1 o'clock, and drive here to the Springfield Country Club, and play there from 8 to 12, and get back into New Haven at about 4 in the morning, with no chance to study my classes and my first assignments for the next day, for $8, getting $1,500 for an hour was just incredible to me.
The voice of Rudy Vallee, whose name was a household word during the golden age of radio. Tonight, we present a two-hour special, The Rudy Vallee Story, brought to you by Barrett Mutual Savings Bank, the only savings bank in New England with mutual in its name, and by Heritage Woods, the new adult condominium community in Avon, Farmington, where you can really enjoy living.
The Rudy Vallee Dream Shampoo Show.
I am on table six.
They're ready to go. They're flashing you. All right, everybody. Quiet, please. Quiet. This is Vallee in Studio A. Stand by to take off our rehearsal. All set? Here we go. Stopwatch. My partner, it's dancing time. The clock says 10. Won't you say when? I'm ready, go steady when we begin. The time is right. I think we might just dance it and dance it away tonight. My time is your time. We just seem to synchronize and sympathize. We're harmonizing one step and two steps. Old steps and new steps. There's no time like our time and no one like.
Begin this two-hour special, The Rudy Vallee Story, here on the Golden Age of Radio, right after this message. Choosing where you will bank is for some people a matter of taste or convenience. For others, a matter of economics. Banking at Burritt Mutual Savings Bank might satisfy all of these preferences for you. Over the years, since 1889 to be exact, Burritt has always tried to be friendly and cooperative in its relationship with people. Our officers and tellers are particularly selected for these qualities. From a business standpoint, Burritt is large, strong, and successful. It is a mutual type of institution organized and operated for you, the customer. Offices are maintained at two locations in New Britain, at Corbin's Corner in West Hartford, and another will be open this fall on Town Line Road, Rocky Hill, to serve Weathersfield and Rocky Hill people. You are always welcome at Burritt, either as a depositor or a borrower. As the only bank in New England with mutual in its name, We have to live up to the reputation of being the People's Bank. Burrett Mutual Savings Bank, member FDIC. This is Dick Bertel, and with me to share this hour of radio memories once again is the man with 2,000 hours of radio memories on tape, Mr. Ed Corcoran. Well, Ed, not only are we doing tonight's program on location, backstage at the Starleton Theater here in West Springfield, but our guest is a giant of the golden age of radio.
Yes, it's really hard to list all the accomplishments of this man, Dick, but he was a musician, a band leader, a singer, a master of ceremonies, a comedian, a nightclub performer, a movie star, a recording artist, but primarily, as you say, a giant in the field of radio.
You're talking, of course, about Rudy Vallee. And Rudy, it's a pleasure to welcome you to the golden age of radio. And it's appropriate that we're doing this show from Springfield, because in a sense, this is where your career began. At a place, if my memory serves me correctly, called the Springfield Country Club.
A very amusing story about that first engagement at the Springfield Country Club. I wrote from Maine to the registrar of the Yale College, Joseph R. Ellis, not knowing that he loved the football band and lived for Yale football band, smoked a pipe of steel blue eyes that just drilled you with a rigidity and a quality, a piercing quality, Joe Ellis's eyes. And I said, do you think I'll be able to find any work when I go to Yale, when I go to New Haven? And he wrote, he said, I think you can. And he said, there's a banjoist by the name of Sleepy Hall, who's very popular, and I think he can possibly find some work for you. Now, I had a chance to go to Harvard as a provisional sophomore, where I could have played in a Chinese restaurant in Boston, $30 a week, $5 a night for 6 nights, and be home in my dormitory at 12:30, 12:45. Whereas in New Haven, from what he wrote me, I knew pretty well that the jobs would not be in New Haven, but be at the colleges and campuses all around, even as far as Poughkeepsie and Worcester. And as I say, for $8 to $10. But I just chose Yale for some reason. And I came to New Haven. I stopped off in Meriden to see a fellow from Maine, from my little university of Maine, Marlon Welch, who was working for the Meriden Journal. We went to a little, the Mattis Cafe in New Haven. And that evening, Jack Cipriano, a pianist from Yale, a Yale graduate in 1914, who was a lawyer, was entertaining Bonnie Raitt. Remember Bonnie Raitt and his orchestra from New Haven? Bonnie was going to the Brown Hotel in Louisville, which he played every summer, or every fall, I guess it was. And Bonnie was being entertained by Jack, and they were feeling no pain. And Mylan had told them that I was a saxophonist. So they said that Jack left me his cards, called the name Jack Cipriano, and he said, we have an orchestra. We worked our way through Yale. He and his partner, Bill Bolton, who played the violin. And he said, look us up when you come to New Haven, which is only 2 or 3 days away. So the next day I was in New Haven, and I went down to the Taft building to see Bolton, who had an office there, and Jack had an office there too. And Bolton was always a very suspicious type of person. And I showed him some of my clippings, and I showed him the offer that I'd had to go to London that fall to play at the Savoy Hotel for $140 a week, £28, and my transportation over to go with Carol Gibbons, who was a pianist from Duke and Massachusetts, who wrote Garden in the Rain, a very fabulous pianist. And on the strength of what I told them, they said, we'll take a chance on you. We've got a job for you. Your first day at Yale, Thursday, October, whatever it was. And we would like to have you play it for us. And I said, fine. And they'd never heard me play, mind you now. So the first day, I got my assignments in the afternoon. And at 1 o'clock, there was this big limousine with Sleepy Hall, who played banjo, a drummer who was not a Yale man, Bolton, who was, Cipriano, who was, and a banjoist who was a New Haven boy. I mean, one of my top banjoists was the bass player, was a New Haven fellow, but not a Yale man. We get into the big limousine. Now, as we're driving up there, I tell him how I had this chance to go to London with 12 other musicians from one from California, two from New York, four from Boston, five from Boston, and among them was Howard Jacobs, who was a flutist originally, but he learned the saxophone. He had a fabulous technique. A rather thin tone, where I had a great tone, but no technique at all. I never studied exercise. I just spent 5 hours a day on long tones to build this tremendous control of tone. And I had this tone patterned after my idol, Rudy Weedoff, the great saxophonist from 1920. And I tell him enough about this, and then I tell him other things that have him sort of wondering what I'm going to sound like on the saxophone. As we drive along this trip up to Springfield, then more or less, now beginning to feel rather uneasy. They're stuck with me tonight if I play a lousy horn. So we get to the country club, and it appears that only that particular Yale prom preceding that October, the February preceding that October, the ox had been from Boston. There's Bert Lowe and his ox. Bert Lowe used to do a great deal of society work in Boston, as Meyer Davis does in New York today. And Bert Lowe came down to play the Yale Farm with 30 Boston musicians, among them Howard Jacobs, who had stood on this great big top they played up very high in some place there in the dining hall, Yale Dining Hall, with a straight soprano saxophone. And they said he was just sensational. When he played his horn, everybody looked at him, because the saxophone was a god instrument at the time. Anybody who could play the horn well became a deity. And now they're beginning to be very uneasy. So we get there, and the Scotch steward, who decides what ox will play there at the country club, kept telling them that the Saturday before we played there, we played on, I think it was a Thursday night, the Saturday before there had been a dance, and Bert Lowe had the dance. And he said, "You should have heard Bert Lowe. You should have heard Bert Lowe." And he kept ramming this up, Bolton Cipriano, who wanted this steady job. This was our tryout night for this job, not only for me, but for the orchestra from New Haven. So then when I asked for E flat instead of the tone A to tune to, everybody tunes to A because it's the open string on the violin. Nobody ever thought of the fact that when you play A on an E flat alto saxophone, you have to put three fingers down on this finger here. That means that you cannot move the mouthpiece and blow at the same time because both hands are fingering the keys. Whereas you blow the E flat, you put the middle finger of the left hand down, and you can adjust the mouthpiece until you get exactly the same pitch as the piano note that they're hitting on the piano. When I said E flat, they looked at you and they said, "Oh my God." They're now ready to die. So the first song we played that evening was a song written to come. Nobody knows, not the trouble I've seen, that's an old Negro spiritual, but there's a song, something like that, a lovely melody, written by Felix Pont, who wrote Nola, the great piano number Nola. Felix Pont's tune, which is very popular at that particular time. I'd never played it before. But the first chorus, I just was played very soft in the background, and Bolton took the violin straight melody. Then they turned to me to hear me play the second chorus on the saxophone. Well, after I blew about 8 or 10 minutes, I did have a lovely tone. They all looked at each other and decided with great relief that I was here from them on. I played the all of them game for Bolton Supreme.
The Rudy Valley Story, being featured tonight here on the Golden Age of Radio, will continue right after this message from Lou Palmer. When you visit Heritage Woods, an adult condominium community located in the lovely countryside of Avon Farmington, you know right away it's something different. Its beauty and quality come through in every detail. Now that's because every detail was thoroughly planned in advance, like the walkways. Normally there's nothing extraordinary about a walkway, it's merely a means for people to go from one place to another. Sure, it seems like a little thing, but not to Paparazzo Heritage Corporation, creators of this beautiful country community. At Heritage Woods, the walkways were really planned. Designers actually walked through the hundreds of acres of land, selecting areas with good views and interesting highlights. When they found a particularly exciting vantage point, they constructed overlooks or gazebos, where a person could rest and chat with friends while enjoying the scenery. Rock formations, flower plantings, and natural landscaping were added to further enhance the views. See for yourself. Take a walk through Heritage Woods. It's on Route 167 off Route 4 in Farmington. Open daily from 10 a.m. to 7 p.m. Go this week while the fall foliage is at its peak.
Well, Rudy, your radio career began long before the Fleischmann's Hour. You know, of course, that's the show that everybody remembers you for. I believe you started at the High Hope Club in New York. Actually, when did you start there?
We went into the High Hope Club on January 8, 1928. Bert Lahm, who suffered and became quite an orchestra leader, was a boy who used to sell typewriters and learned two, three keys of two chords on the piano and somehow talked himself into getting a lot of society work up around White Plains for the debutante parties there, Princeton dances and so forth. So I wanted to tell a great musician, nobody knows that he really couldn't play much piano. And I bumped into Bert and he said, "Would you like a job?" And I said, not a steady job, but I said, "I've got a little girl from New Jersey I'd like to see." And I said, if I could lead the band, yes, I would like that. I'd only led one band before, and I was at the Westchester Biltmore Country Club at Rye, New York, where I led a five-piece band, because Bolton Cipriano couldn't make it some weekends. I led it one weekend. They liked me so well, they said, "You do the lead and tell Bolton Cipriano to stay back in New Haven." So I said, "Like," he said, "fine." So we went in there on the night of January 8th, 1928. I brought two boys from New Haven, Cliff Burwell, who wrote Sweet Lorraine, played a marvelous piano. It sounded like a pianola, like a piano roll. Joe Miller, who since deceased, played marvelous tenor saxophone. The others were boys that Lon had picked. So we go in with two strings, two saxes, and four rhythm on the night of January 29, 28. and I was going to do the singing. The singing to be done by a boy named Jules DeVos, who now sells real estate in Palm Springs. Jules faked the violin. He didn't really play well, but he had a second violin. And he had the typical trained that type of trained voice. And he was to do the singing. Don Dickerman, who owned the club, sits there with about four or five persons, and nobody in a lovely little place, very exclusive, very smart club, just below the Star Club on 53rd Street. And we played three or four numbers, DeVorsen sang three or four numbers, and I could see Dickerman wasn't very happy. And I went to the table and I said, "How do you like us?" He said, "I don't care much for the singer." I saw the job going right out the window. So I went back, and at the Yale Spring Dancers, I had sung a song in Vogel with the Yale Collegians the summer before, the summer 27. In the Spring Dancers, I'd also sung a song, a tune called Rain. Rain, it's so cozy in the rain. So I said to Cliff, "Do you remember Rain? He played with us at the Spring Dancers anyway." And he said, "Yes." So I got a little saxophone that I cut down and I had in the bell of my baritone saxophone, which I had used at the Society Resorts in Maine in 1924, before I went to London to play the Savoy. So I got the little bell saxophone out, and I sang a tune or two. I sang Rain, of course. We played a chorus of two clarinets, a piano chorus, two violin chorus, and I came back again to the chorus. Dickerman said to me, he said, "You do the singing." To this day, the divorcee thinks I double-crossed him. But actually, I say today. Now, that's about February that we started. I mean, January started there at the club that night. And about February, Lon came in, he said, we're going to broadcast in the club. He said, we're going to broadcast in the club on a little station called the American Broadcasting System, selling Greeby radios, Atlantic Broadcasting System, Atlantic, with offices in Steinway Hall, and broadcasting from my old club every night over to sell Greeby radios and stuff like that. It's fine. They said, so that afternoon the broadcast, down comes this man in a tuxedo, dark glasses, and the black hair, and he said, "I'm a Yale graduate too. His name is Samson." He said, "We can't afford an announcer. You'll have to do your own announcing." And he expected me to fall dead on the floor, so I can't afford it. But I've heard Billy Phelps at Yale. I love the way Phelps talked about things informally, and I've always been easily spoken. My father was easily spoken. So I said, "Fine." And when you got out of the car to get into the Hi-Ho Club, the doorman said, "Hi-Ho, everybody." He said, "Hi-Ho." So I said, "I will say hi-ho, everybody. This is Rudy Valley announcing, directing from the Hi-Ho Club, 35 years ago, the 53rd. Now, in those days, you didn't clear any songs. Nothing was cleared. No censorship. And so we did the broadcast. I picked out a bunch of songs. I went for half an hour. And the next day, I came into the club, and there were 12 letters on the desk, the captain's desk, and they were all addressed to me. They did not spell my name because I didn't spell it out for them. And these letters all said, "Who are you? You are different. Different, 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 different." And the simple explanation was that in those days you heard Lopez from the Pennsylvania singer, this is Lopez speaking, Ben Bernie singing Yowzer from the Roosevelt Hotel, all playing the same cut and dried stock arrangements of all the show tunes, all the popular tunes that they were. A simple stock arrangement, nobody had a special arrangement. We couldn't play the arrangement because we had no brass. So we had no choice but to just play choruses. And I vowed when I used to play dances at Yale, we played hours at a stretch, and invariably we'd stay in the same key, because the leader didn't know. We were all boys put together for that evening. We didn't know each other the night before. Many times we were just put together for the evening, and nobody knew how to go from one chorus to another. Nobody knew where to make the chord change to go from F to G. And we took that for F, and I fell asleep half the time, because playing in one key for an hour and a half is like being in a room with everything in one color. I thought if I ever had an orchestra, we would never play two choruses in the same key. Now, we're only going to play choruses, because that's all we can do. So every time we went from F to G to A flat to B flat to C, always mounting up for color, because keys have color. And these letters, it's very simple to understand how the jaded New York listener at that time, or New Jersey, Pennsylvania, dialing in this station with tremendous coverage, they were accustomed to this other stuff, always the same type of tune, the same way. But here's a fellow who said his name is Rudy Valley. They immediately pictured George Raft. Patent leather hair, slow eyes, has to be. But he talks through his nose like Coolidge, philosophizes in the manner of Billy Phelps, and he plays tunes that I brought back from London, like Georgie Porgy, If You're the Only Girl, other songs I brought back, poems. No, I thought that I didn't broadcast it. But I had these tunes that I brought back from London that nobody else had, and the listener said, "Who are you? You're different, 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 and only choruses, always in different keys." And the pianist had such a wonderful piano style, with the result that at the end of about a month and a half, we were getting thousands of letters a week. So WOR came over and said, would you broadcast with us? I said, certainly. So he comes in. And WMCA says, we broadcast.
So you're being paid for these broadcasts.
No. These are sustaining. The guy comes over with the outfit and sets up the boxes. You boys did it tonight. So now we're on 21. We're on Sunday nights. 7 nights a week. From 7 until 3 in the morning. 8 hours a night. With the result that, well, no. The broadcast, let's say 8 to 9 on WABC. I'd say, tune in again at 10 o'clock. We'll be on WOR. I said, tune in again at 1 o'clock in the morning, be WMCA. No clearance, no tunes. Say anything you want to talk about, anything you like to do. No clearance, no sense to do anything. Well, in about 8 or 9 months, the boys complained one night about 2 o'clock in the morning, cold sandwiches. And I said, boys, in a few weeks, we're going to make so much money. We're going to be such a sensation that just don't complain about the sense. Just take it easy, boys.
We'll be back in a moment.
Susie, hand me the phone book, will you please? What are you looking for, Kathy? Banks. Savings banks. Let's see. Here's one in the yellow pages. Burritt Mutual Savings Bank. Main Street, New Britain. Slater Road, New Britain. Corbin's Corner, West Hartford. Compounds dividends monthly. Pays day of deposit to day of withdrawal interest. Certificates of deposit at 6% for 2 years and 5.75% for 1 year.
You want to start a savings bank account, Kathy?
Yes, and definitely Burritt.
Why Burritt?
Because it's a mutual bank, Susie. It's working for us. You own part of it if you're a depositor, and its profits go to you.
Say, can I start an account there with you, Kathy? Gosh, I'd love to have a bank working for me.
Just a reminder that you're listening to the Golden Age of Radio from WTIC in Hartford. Tonight, we're presenting the Rudy Vallee Story.
A song player named Sammy Smith. He's a punch-drunk baseball player with a sweet, big, hulking, real little Lenny over the gob of the ear. You know the play with Lenny, the big guy, and the little guy in the mice and men. Sammy Smith believes that Rudy, I should just sing. I know what's going to happen. He brought Earl Carroll over. Carroll couldn't sing the things. So then he brought Bill McCaffrey over. Bill McCaffrey now manages Art Carney for years. Bill is at the Keith office in the Palace Theater building, booking the Keith theaters. McCaffrey came over, and he said, I don't think he's a guy, but Sammy Smith said, give him at least a 3 or 4 weekend at the 81st Street Theater. McCaffrey went back to the Palace Theater. He said to the girls in the office, crazy. So he said, I'll give you $400 for Friday, Saturday, and Sunday, 2 shows a day at the 81st Street Theater, Keith Theater. I said, fine. We go to the theater. I announce it for 3 weeks before from where we're broadcasting. And, of course, the opening day, the lines for miles. You couldn't get near the theater. They pushed the manager out of the lobby. He couldn't understand not having a radio. He didn't understand how radio works. And each individual home used to write me saying, we have discovered it. We. To them, each person not knowing next door, they're also tuning in on us. And when we played certain songs, they tried to rip the seats and threw them in the air. When we played, I love you, I love you, I love you, you are the girl, oh, maybe nobody else had it. Dean Mack, when we played our song, Only Girl in the World, nobody else had these tunes. They went crazy.
Would it be possible to hear the band as it must have sounded at the Keith Theater at that time?
Well, gee, I think we can, Dick, because I do have a recording made about that time, and this, of course, is when Rudy was at his peak, when he was really, top of the heap as far as the recordings were concerned, and this was the recording we have of Deep Night.
Thank you.
Deep Nights with Rudy back in 1929. At Heritage Woods, the new adult condominium community in Avon, Farmington, every little detail is considered important. Take the selection of a street lamp design, for example. It seems like a little thing. Maybe it is ordinarily. But Heritage Woods isn't ordinary. Paparazzo Heritage Corporation, creators of this country community, considered a number of styles offered by many manufacturers, but none satisfied them. Since many hundreds of lamps were required to accommodate the 400 acres of Heritage Woods, they wanted a style that would complement the unique architecture of the homes and the natural beauty of the area. What did they do? Well, they designed and manufactured the lamps themselves. Of course, it wasn't the easy way out, but then beauty and quality don't come easy. Visit Heritage Woods. It's on Route 167 off Route 4 in Farmington. Open daily from 10 a.m. to 7 p.m. Tomorrow is Hospitality Day at Heritage Woods. They'll serve coffee, tea, and pastries from 10 a.m. till noon. Stop in and hear Mr. Henry Fow discuss sewing and designing with the new 1971 fabrics. Mr. Fow operates the Fabrics Plush Shop at the Bazaar in Southbury. Rudy, let's get back to that story at the Key Theater. What happened that first night after the show and the enthusiastic reception?
Well, after the second show that night, I was asked to go upstairs to the top old deserted office. They didn't use anymore. Here's a God for your books, all the Key Theaters. He said, will you play all of the Key Theaters for us, 13 of them? I said, yes. And he said, what would you want? I said, I know $1,500 for 8 men is a lot of money. Laughing, said, well, yes, it is, but I think we can pay it. I said, a little more for the dollars. He said, if I'd asked for $15,000, I could have gotten it. Nip with me. So I come out that first night. Arthur Piantedosi, the brother of Al Piantedosi, or the girl named Bird in the Gilded Cage, is standing out on the side of it. George is with Shapiro Bernstein, I think. He said, Rudy, you've got to have a manager. I told him that happened upstairs. You've got to have a manager. Now, at this time, we were broadcasting from what is now the Copacabana. It was then become the Villa Valley. We'd been thrown out of the High Oak Club when I was 26 years. And about this time, they decided for the man who brings over the gadget that sets up for the sustained broadcast, you must pay $25 each night he comes over, or $25 for the week, maybe. So, the thing, you got to bring this stuff over. And the owner of the 26th place said, pay, they should pay us to have you. I said, Mr. Bellack, they insist on you pay. Otherwise, I've got to have this lifeline, I'm dead. And he said, I won't pay it. So, Peter goes to Rudy, I think NBC will put a wire on your Villa Valley, your High Oak Club, I mean the 1060s, for nothing, which of course they were happy to do. But I have to sign with NBC. So I signed with NBC, and that was the beginning of eventually the placement hour and pictures and all the other things that followed.
Rudy, what sort of a contact did you have with NBC?
At that time, you boys probably don't remember this. NBC had what they called the Artist Service Bureau, which was managing personalities for radio. They had Lopez, and they asked me to sign not only an NBC contract to only broadcast with NBC, but also to be managed by the Artist Service Bureau, which they managed me about a year. And then the government stepped in, as they did with Amateur Music Corporation of America and some of the other corporations, and said, look, you may not handle talent and present it, too. You can either do one or the other, just as they did to MCA. They said, you can't handle talent and also put them into pictures and so on and so forth. So MCA gave up its talent agency, now only makes pictures for television. And that was the situation there, so NBC no longer managed me after about 1931. But from 1929 to 31, I was managed by the Artist Service Bureau, and a fellow named Ed Shewing was delegated to handle me and Lopez. He may have had somebody else, but he had some operatic stars, too. And then a man named George Engel, E-N-G-E-L, was in charge of the NBC Artist Service Bureau, and he committed suicide. I'll never forget, in 1932, I went to the coast to see my wife, Faye Webb. I was in George White Scandals, Pennsylvania Grill, playing dances in the evening after the show, and doing my slice now from New York and three sustaining broadcasts from the Pennsylvania Grill. And I came out, and my wife and Faye Webb on the coast 3 or 4 months, and they're getting a little unhappy and jittery, so I went out to see her for 2 weeks, and somebody else pinched it for me in the broadcast and so on. And I came back, I bought a home on the coast for $80,000, came back to the coast, I said to George Engel, this man was in charge of the Artist Service Bureau of NBC. I said, do you ever think that broadcasting will be anything at all on the coast? That I just bought a home there. He said, Rudy, there will never be any broadcasting from California. Madison Avenue wants control of it right in New York, and there will never be any broadcasting. And he always had this period. He had this period. He said, there will never be any big broadcasting from California, period.
Rudy Valley is our guest tonight here on the Golden Age of Radio. And we come now to the start of the placement hour.
Well, Victor Kleifenauer was the first of the variety shows and certainly the most popular, and I think it set a new format for radio at that time.
I guess it did, Ed. Rudy, was the Fleischmann-Hour handled by one of the agencies?
NBC got that for me. One thing that Chewy and NBC did get for me, which I'll be deeply grateful, because they could have gotten me a show that might have lasted 34 weeks or something like that and gone off the air. But the Fleischmann-Hour, which started originally as an hour broadcast on, they took a bad night, Thursday night. It was a poor evening, 8 to 9, and we had one guest who appeared in the first minute segment, 15-minute segment, the second 15-minute segment, and the last 15-minute segment. Half after quarter had nobody. That is just we played medleys that ran 10 minutes long. And, of course, not being at the end and not realizing how deadly monotonous these things were, to hear that little band of eight pieces playing 10 minutes of choruses, it was murderous, and I didn't realize it. Still, we were so popular that we were packing in the theaters and everything. John Reber, who was the head of J. Walter Thompson Radio and TV department, later on the TV came in. So Reber came in 32 hours, now playing the George White Scandals at the New Amsterdam Theater, but not the Apollo Theater. And he said, Rudy, they're going to take the bankroll, the rubber band off the bankroll of J. Walter Thompson and Standard Brands, and they're going to spend enough money, well, they consider $4,000 or $5,000 a lot of money. Because our program at that time, I was getting $2,500. For 7 men myself for this broadcast, which was the number one broadcast, $2,500, of which I'd pay my boys. I said, boys, you'll always get, the fee at that time was $25 for a 3-hour rehearsal and a 1-hour broadcast for the musicians. I said, boys, you would all get $75 a fee. So I gave him $50 more than I had to. I said, boys, when we make money, you will make it with me. So Reba said to me, we're going to now have a variety show. Because in my book, which I read in 1929, I stressed in one chapter, variety, that you must have constant kaleidoscopic changing of this, that, but never give them sameness. So the theory that Reba, himself, J. Walter Thompson, contributed to the program was to have, if possible, a comedian for an opener, like a Lou Holtz. Then, if possible, we'd have an interview spot where we'd take a little groundhog who's working in the Holland Tunnel with his little hard cap, and he tells how his faith in God and his prayers each day gave him the courage to work in that tunnel. No, at any moment it might be destroyed and flooded and die. Then we would have an excerpt from Yellow Jacket, one of the Broadway shows on Broadway. We'd take a 12-minute excerpt from the show and get the best and other players from the show, do that 12-minute excerpt. And then we'd have maybe a novelty spot and a bunch of Trinidad boys that had come up with the Trinidad songs. We'd put them on and close with a comedian. That was the format where we could keep it that way. We varied all the time. And the thing just snowballed into become the Palace Theater. They had the Ed Sullivan Show of radio, and it became the greatest thing of this kind we presented. Everybody but Kate Smith, but Jack Benny, who was too young.
Ladies and gentlemen, this announcement is for the special attention of the Weathersfield and Rocky Hill residents. Burritt Mutual Savings Bank will open a new branch in your area this fall. A bright new office, staffed by people from Rocky Hill and Weathersfield, will open in the Charles Schneer Shopping Center on Town Line Road in Rocky Hill. This center is just south of the Clam Box Restaurant at the border of your two towns. Caldor's has already opened there. Watch for announcements of this opening. Remember, Burritt Mutual Savings Bank, the bank that has mutual in its name and where you, the depositor, own the bank. It's coming to your area, and soon.
Well, you mentioned some of the names that were on that program. You introduced
some of them
Edgar Bergen and Charlie McCarthy.
Some were my personal discoveries, and others were persons that the agency found. Bergen was at a party that Elsa Maxwell gave at the Waldorf Astoria, an old coward, on a Saturday night. I was in Canada playing exposition in Toronto. And I'd seen Bergen work at the Shea Ferry in Chicago, so I knew his work, but it never occurred to me to put him on radio. Nobody said, what about it? I said, yes, which he did. Don't worry what he has, a live dummy or a wooden dummy. But I came back the next day, and they said, with great care and trembling, they said, we're going to put it in place. I said, why not? They said, Bergen. I said, I saw him at the Shea Ferry. They liked him so well at the Noel Coward party that Monday morning they auditioned him over at the Thompson office, and they said, if Rudy will go for it, you'll go on this coming Thursday. So I came back, and I said, fine, sure. So at the rehearsal, I said to Bergen, you're going to use the country dummy, aren't you? Because I love Mortimer Sweard. Now, Bergen is a very timid man, and he said, do you think I should? Now, had I said yes,
that would have been it.
He would not use McCarthy probably at all, mm-hmm. and he would never make the impact that McCarthy made, because McCarthy is the alter ego, the imp in all of us, who dares to say what we'd like to say but don't dare to say.
That's right.
Snurd is great, but he doesn't have half, one-tenth the impact of the other thing. I said, Edgar, this is your first time close to close. You use the figure you want to use. I always did that to all of us. In fact, I had a whole pants up to keep him falling on the floor. He was just frightened out of his wits.
Well, Rudy, as a matter of fact, Ed has the original recording of Bergen and McCarthy on your show. Ed, how far does this go back?
Well, as near as I can figure, it must go back to around 1936 and 1937. I think that's when they first appeared. And the excerpt we're going to hear, we have Rudy making the introduction. And then, again, the very first time that Edgar Bergen ever appeared on National Network Radio.
Why put a ventriloquist on the air? The answer is, why not? True, our ventriloquist, Edgar Bergen, is an unusual one, thought of Noel Coward or perhaps Fred Allen among ventriloquists. A dexterous fellow who depends more upon the cleverness and wit of his material than upon the believe-it-or-not nature of his delivery. Mr. Bergen works with a dummy, arrayed in top hat and tails. Just imagine the dummy, and take my word for it that both voices you will hear are owned and operated by just one man, Edgar Bergen.
Good evening, ladies and gentlemen. As Rudy told you, my friend here is arrayed in considerable splendor.
Yes, indeed, yes.
And now, young man, I would like to know why you're dressed in tails and top hat and monocle. Where did the money come from?
Oh, the Mazuma.
Yes.
Well, I'll tell you.
I wish you would.
You see, my stepfather.
Yes.
He passed away.
I see.
And when he died, he left me 200 smackers.
Oh, he did.
Yes.
Well, I'm sorry to hear about your stepfather.
What's the matter? What did he do now?
No, I mean, passing away.
Oh, yes, of course. Yes, yes. Well, what about it?
Well, I mean, it's sad.
Oh, yes. Yes, it was.
Yes.
Yes, it was sad, really.
Yes.
But then, on the other hand, 200 bucks ain't to be sneezed at either.
No, you're right. Well, tell me, is your mother living yet?
No, not yet.
Not yet. No.
No, she isn't.
Well, what is the name, if I may ask?
The name?
Yes.
Now that I have money.
I see.
It's Bembe.
Bembe.
Oh, yes. Bembe. I'm one of the Fishwell Bembes.
Oh, I see.
One of the walking on the Thames Fishwell Bembes. Oh.
You like it over in England?
Oh, simply marvelous.
I imagine so.
Yes.
Yes. Well, what do you like most of all?
I'd love to go grouse hunting in the Scottish uplands.
I see. Well, did you have any luck this fall shooting?
Oh, definitely.
Oh, fine.
The very first day out, I got 3 Cocker Spaniels.
Oh, you did?
And the second day, I got a horse.
A horse.
And my host.
And your host.
I don't miss a darn thing.
I know.
If it moves, I shoot. Oh, it's good fun.
I imagine so.
Yes.
Well, young man, I don't believe you were grouse shooting.
You don't?
No. And I don't believe you were over in England.
Oh, come now. Don't be a twerp.
Well, I do.
You don't believe me?
I don't believe you.
Well, heck, I tried.
Yes, I know. So what is it?
Charlie McCarthy.
Oh, I do.
But how could you tell?
Well, you see, Charlie, I am a mind reader.
Is that so?
Yes. And I am a student of psychic phenomena.
Yes. The kid's clever.
Yes. You see, I have a crystal here.
Yes, so you have.
When I gaze into the crystal, everything goes out of focus. It's just like gazing into a whirlpool.
A whirlpool?
Yes.
What's a whirlpool?
What is a whirlpool?
Now, I ask you first, all right.
You have never seen a whirlpool?
No. Awfully sorry.
Oh, that's all right.
I will say this, though. Not so long ago, I fell in a pool.
Oh, you fell in a pool?
Yes.
But it wasn't a whirlpool?
No. Awfully sorry.
Oh, that's all right.
It was a cesspool.
I was sorry for that, too.
I imagine.
But, my good young man, that is neither here nor there.
No, I was up in Connecticut.
All right. Well, now, what would you like to have me tell you about the future while I have the crystal here?
Would you tell me if there's any work in sight?
Any work?
Yes.
You're interested in a position?
Mildly, yes.
I Well, yes, Charlie, I do see a position here.
Oh, goody, goody, goody.
Yes. But I'm afraid the position won't do you much good.
Why, what's the matter?
Well, it seems that your cocktail parties interfere with your work.
Oh, I wouldn't say that.
It looks very bad, young man.
Oh, well, I never overdo those things.
Oh, you don't?
No, I never take more than four or five scotch and sodas.
Four or five scotch and sodas.
Oh, that's all.
Oh, my goodness. Well, I should think four or five scotch and sodas would make you awfully drunk.
Yeah, well, it helps.
Don't you know, young man, that alcohol...
Yes?
Alcohol is nothing but slow poison.
Is what?
It's slow poison.
Yes.
Slow poison? That's what it is.
Slow poison.
Yes.
Well, I'm in no hurry. Well, let me...
That was a tremendous break, of course, for Edgar Bergen and Charlie McCarthy, and a hilarious script. And there's a story that we told, as a matter of fact, on this program, Ed, if you'll recall, that Edgar Bergen said, I can't possibly appear regularly on radio because I've been polishing that particular script for 15 years. He didn't realize, of course, that they had radio writers. And 10 years later, he and Rudy, of course, you were there, did a parody on that original show.
Yes, and it's a short excerpt, but it's very funny because it sort of characterizes the personality that Rudy projects over radio, you know, kind of the, you have to hear the sketch to appreciate it, but it really is a typical interchange between Rudy Valley and Charlie McCarthy.
Are you sure this is Rudy Valley's office?
Oh, it must be. There's a picture of Rudy Valley looking at a picture of Rudy Valley.
Yes.
Excellent thing. Rudy Valley.
Please.
Welcome, your furniture.
Mr. Valley, we came to talk to you about your radio program.
Yes, awfully good, isn't it?
Well, it's not that so much.
Just what are you fellows doing here?
Well, I'm a ventriloquist.
A what?
A ventriloquist. I talk through my stomach.
That's nothing. I sing through my nose. Acrobats, jugglers, now ventriloquists. I have everything thrown at me.
Even grapefruit.
Oh, this is a thankless job. I spend my days and nights looking for talent, high and low.
Oh, why don't you hire us?
I hadn't intended to look that low.
Well, we promised to work hard.
Well, are you reliable? You boys don't drink, do you?
No, drink? We hardly eat.
Well, I'm trying to take a chance on you anyway, against my better judgment.
Oh, thank you, Mr. Valley, thank you. I deeply appreciate your generosity. Oh, stop licking his hand. And now, Mr. Valley, what about money?
Oh, that's all right. You won't have to pay me anything.
You have a story about Joe Petter that I'd like to share with our audience, Rudy. When was he on the show?
It would be about 1934, 35. And Joe Petter, with whom I worked at the Brooklyn Time out there, he does a portion of the show where he says, you're supposed to ask me, how do you raise corned beef and cabbage? And I'm supposed to say, I don't know. And he said, with a knife and fork. Yeah, I cut it. And at the last night, I always threw him up. The last show of the whole week, I'd say, I give him all the answers. Well, I'm not supposed to. I went over to the, now we were broadcasting at this time from the Radio City was just being built over at the, it was already built. Radio City is about 34, 35. But we preferred to broadcast at the top of the Amsterdam Theater building because they had a lovely theater, which used to be the Midnight Frolics in Zig Jalad. And they had a glass curtain we could bring down to shut out any coughing noise during the dramatic sketch of our show. This beautiful glass curtain would roll down, beautiful and roll up.
Those are facts that people just don't know about today. But go on, I don't know.
Anyway, I see Joe Pennant in the corner rehearsing something. I said, what are you rehearsing? He said, a song called Flies, F-L-I-E-S, that they had written for this broadcast. I said, aren't you going to do When the Pussy Willows Whisper to the Cat? To the Cat? He said, no, they don't like it. I went to Gordon Thompson. I said, Gordon, this man is a worrier. You're going to ask him to memorize the things he's been doing for 40 years in Bordeaux. He gets out there, even with a sheet music in front of him, and forgets the melody, and can't read, and he's going to walk right off the stage. And he's got a theme song. It's a very funny song. Not a theme song, but a song that we've been doing for years. And Gordon and I never had any trouble. He said, okay. I could throw away the little thing. And I know what has happened to that man. Of course, he was on our show for 3 weeks in a row. So great. So enthusiastic. Same with Bergen, that the baker department of Fleischer & Greaves came and said, would you take our baker show? And probably paid him $5,000 for himself. And said, what do you think his theme song was in the show? When the pussy was with the they got it.
There's a new country community near Hartford where ducklings that walk across the road always get the right of way. They should. They were the first residents, along with swans, geese, squirrels, and other wildlife. The community is Heritage Woods in Avon, Farmington. It's the newest development by Paparazzo Heritage Corporation, the folks who created famous Heritage Village in Southbury. Well, now they've done it again. At Heritage Woods, the luxury architecture and landscaping blend right in with unspoiled nature. You get the feeling that the buildings and trees, the wildlife, the lakes, the private golf course, everything just naturally belongs together. And wouldn't it be nice for a change to enjoy golfing, swimming, or just plain loafing without worrying about chores? At Heritage Woods, all the outside maintenance is done for you. Treat yourself to a visit to Heritage Woods. It's on Route 167 off Route 4 in Farmington. Open daily from 10 a.m. to 7 p.m. Drive down, but remember, the ducklings have the right of way. Rudy Valley is our guest tonight here on the Golden Age of Radio. Well, we talked about the Fleischman Hour, Ed, but that was followed by another smash, wasn't it, for Rudy?
Yes, it was the Seal Test Hour, which was really even a greater show, perhaps, than the Fleischman Hour.
How did the Seal Test Show get started, Rudy?
The Seal Test Show is very interesting. I did the Fleischman Hour from 29 to 39. 32 on it was a great variety show. 39, they decided 10 years the Santa Brands was enough, and I agreed with them. So they said, we're all part of good friends. They gave me a beautiful Cape Art phonograph and a lovely dinner, and we had a wonderful time now. A few months later, National Dairies, which is James Seal Test, got all these dairies to pool their money together for a radio show, and they took a poll of the housewives. Would you be interested in a show at Rooney Valley? They said, yes. So I said, I would like a show called A Rehearsal. In other words, if we will have our two studio props, Jimmy Gleason and Ed Brophy, Willie Fung is my Chinese valet, Gabby Hayes is my ranch foreman, I've got a dumb secretary, a beautiful straight secretary, Fritz Fell is my title French librarian, and Vince Vonnet is the Nance clarinet player. All for goodness sakes, and all these little characters that were the real part of this show, and we'll never see the actual show put on. Just as we finish, at the end of the hour, the show is about to be launched. And all the things that happen in the rehearsal, putting on the mutes, on the violins, and the trumpets, it would be exactly like Jack Benny used to start his show,
right,
with everybody meeting at home,
right,
talking
right
about the show they're going to do that week. This was in the same thing. And they agreed that they would do this show in Miami Beach, where I talked, and they said, love it, great, so and so on. Vic Knight, who used to do the Kate Smith show, the top of by one point, and then Vic was out of work when Kate Smith show finished. Vic Knight, they chose him. I picked Vic Knight as producer because he'd been doing a good job with Kate Smith. He meets Paul Henning at the Brown Derby late at night, and Henning said, I've got 40 historical sequences. Christopher Columbus, Captain John Smith, Rudy plays each one each week with a different gallery. And they said, that's what we want. And so they came in and they said, we don't want the rehearsal. I said, I insist that we do both before an audience and let the audience be the judge. We did the rehearsal thing. Later on, we did the Captain John Smith and Mary Boland as Queen Isabella, and I was Captain John Smith. Slapsy Max was a regular feature. I've been reading Captain John Smith, Christopher Columbus. I was firing, knocks me out, dream music. Then for that, about 18 minutes of the show, it's Christopher Columbus, back again, dream music, to Slapsy Max, revive me and so on. And the next week, Pocahontas, the big guy with the big mouth, Martha Ray, and again, I'm Captain John Smith. I said to these boys, this show you could get anybody to do. Alfred Drake do better than I. I said, this is not Rudy Valley at all. It's going to be, I have to play a character. And I said, it could kill me. I said, this ruined me. And they said, well, please do it for us. We started with March 1940, beginning 17, went down to a summer of four. Wintertime, because we're selling ice cream 52 weeks a year. So I go east to my lodge in Maine, as always I've been doing every summer, and we'll do the broadcast in New York. So they threw Slapsy off. Vic Knight had quit. So we get to New York, we still keep Henning, and we go to New York, and they give me a list of five producers who are available, among them Ed Gardner. I knew Ed Gardner had great ability. So I met him at the Essex House. I said, this is your show, top to bottom. You pick the guest, the stars, you win the entire. All I do is pick my songs. He took that show up like this. We started with, for instance, we got away from the old cantankerous medieval armor type of fire tutu, the Diamond Jim Brady. And the show started inch up now. Well, August, Ed said, we really were going back home in September. What do you think about that? I said, Dad, I heard him on your Texaco show at Christmas time. Christmas of 1939, I think it was, 1940. And that majestic voice booming in this scene that they had for him in this broadcast of the Texaco show. And I said, there'll be days you and I will wonder if he's going to be there. But Ed, it'll be worth it. Never dreaming what he would do for us. So we get off of the coast. Look at the writers we now have. Ed Jordan's getting $500 a week to produce and direct this Steel Test show. It's an hour show. Half hour show. A. Burroughs, $350 a week. Paul Henning is still $250 a week. Panama and Frank, $250 a week. Frank Gehry, $250 a week. And furthermore, let's see, we have Frank Gehry, Charlie Isaacs, Jess Oppenheimer, all for $250 a week.
Rudy, let's stop right here for 5 minutes of the latest news, and then we'll be back with part two of the Rudy Valley story, including more of the shows themselves. Tonight, the Golden Age of Radio is being brought to you by Heritage Woods, the new adult condominium community in Avon, Farmington, where you can really enjoy living. And by Burrick Mutual Savings Bank, the only savings bank in New England with mutual in its name.
Time to shine, shine.